Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking to an evolutionary geneticist. Now, that sounds pretty interesting. And his name is Ben Evans. He's from the Canadian University of McMaster in Hamilton, Ontario. And Ben, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you very much.
Now, before we get into all of the concepts of evolution and genetics and genes and all the rest of it, let's learn a little bit about Ben Evans. How did you get into the area of science? Not specifically what you do now, but way back. What attracted you to science?
It's a good question, and it's sort of hard for me to answer. I think that I've always been interested in being outside. I've always liked to go for hikes and camping, and grew up in Missouri until third grade, and I enjoyed looking for frogs and turtles there. When I was in college, I kind of realized that biology was the thing for me. I started off with engineering courses, and half of my class was sleeping during these courses. But I moved on to biology early in undergraduate school, and was lucky to team up with some professors there and do some field research in the Bahamas and sort of get some field experience. And that was the beginning of a love relationship that's ongoing.
Where did you go to school? Which university?
I went to Tufts University in Boston, near Boston, Medford,
right.
Massachusetts.
And then had your research field down in the Bahamas.
Yeah.
See, that's a thing that chemists and physicists can't quite offer. There aren't too many chemical laboratories of use.
There are chemicals in the Bahamas.
Yeah, right, but not many people seem to go down there. But maybe
true.
I'll reorganize my research. So when you caught your frogs and turtles as a young boy, what did you do with them?
I was pretty friendly to them. I'd usually try to keep them for as long as possible at home. And unfortunately, that usually meant that they would die or get away. But yeah, that was usually the goal, just for observation.
Well, one of my younger boys, he likes turtles. I have no idea why. We were driving down a road once very close to the campus, and there's this turtle in the middle of the road. And I sort of pulled out to pass it. He said, "Dad, stop." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Just stop." So he gets out of the car, gently picks it up. He'd never seen a turtle as I knew it before. He must have seen one on TV, but gently put it on the other side of the road, said, "Okay, now let's carry on."
Yeah, in retrospect, I wish I hadn't caught those animals and taken them out of their habitat. I think that it's exactly the right thing to do, is get them out of harm's way. And
well, we have some
there
in the garden, but I mean, I must say they're very antisocial. You know, it's not like whether it's a dog or a cat. You can go out and take a look at the turtle. You never find it. We know it's there because, you know, it likes fruit and we give it fruit and it eats it and drinks, but pretty hermetic. Anyway, so then, yeah, that was your sort of beginnings. You liked animals out there and then you liked to work in the Bahamas. How did you get into the specifics of sort of what you call evolutionary genetics?
I think that was driven also by an admiration and appreciation for nature. I started off traveling after undergraduate. I had five jobs after undergraduate school, but before graduate school, including work in Alaska and Mexico and Washington. I was a cab driver in New York, and I worked in Kenya. I did a semester abroad as an undergrad in Kenya, and I realized I liked to travel, but I nonetheless started a graduate program in neurobiology, and within a semester got interested in a conservation project in South Africa that involved an endangered species of frog, which was a close relative of the frog that the lab was using for neurobiology questions. And I ended up going to South Africa that summer and working on this species complex and getting more and more interested in conservation and evolutionary questions that sort of attempted to explain the threatened status of that species.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
that was a prelude to what
that's
I'm doing
a sort
now
of an interesting business about the frogs, because one constantly reads in various magazines and the BBC science page, etc., that some people think that the demise of certain frogs is sort of some harbinger of something much more serious.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk about that a little, please?
This is a serious problem. It's, I would say, one of the biggest priorities for conservation in our time right now is the decline of amphibians. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. One is, and I'd say the most pervasive reason for diversity loss, is habitat loss and fragmentation. So there's obviously human development.
By
all
fragmentation,
over the world.
You mean breaking up the
breaking
habitat
up
into
continuous
small parts which aren't necessarily
right.
continuous.
And that's got consequences for the way the ecosystems function. So, for example, when you fragment a habitat, you induce environmental changes in that habitat, commonly called edge effects. So if you have a continuous forest and then you cut a road through the middle of it, you can imagine that the sides of the road will have a different regime of temperature and humidity and sunlight and so on that affect the species that live in that edge area versus the center of the forest. And that changes species composition and reduces the amount of available habitat for those species to live in.
I mean, you can see evidence for that when you drive around in the West or anywhere in the world, actually. On the side of the road, there's always flowers and things.
Absolutely.
They're always in the first 7 feet.
Yep.
And then you look beyond, and there's nothing.
Yep.
And that's a classic example that everybody can see of an edge effect, I presume.
And it gets worse, of course, when you have, instead of just a road through a forest, when you have, you know, entire subdivisions and houses and,
right.
you know, so on. So habitat fragmentation is a major driver of amphibian species decline and extinction. Another major factor is a new pathogen, which is a fungus, like a mushroom, that attacks amphibians and affects the development of tadpoles, which are obviously juvenile amphibians. And in particular, it affects the development of their mouth parts, which are made of a special kind of protein or substance called keratin. And this is a hard substance that the tadpoles use for feeding and scraping material off of plants and so on. And this fungus can affect the development of tadpoles and cause their species decline also. And so there are dozens of species, literally, that have gone extinct as a result of this fungus, and it's called the chytrid fungus. It's spelled C-H-Y-T-R-I-D.
And it crosses species. So, I mean, the implication is...
Which is
not so usual, I think, is it?
Well, yeah. So I think there's a variety of epidemiological patterns that you see in different pathogens. And this is one of those pathogens that can cross the species boundary. In fact, we think that one of the reasons that it has become so widespread throughout the world is that some species can tolerate this pathogen and act as a vector for spreading that pathogen, whereas other species are very susceptible and decline immediately when they get infected.
I mean, is it one of these things that has sort of come because of foreign travel and, you know, the ability to get
pets? Lots of hypotheses out
there,
yeah. One of the hypotheses actually relates to the group of species I work with, which is the clawed frogs, and they're from Africa.
Quad frogs.
Clawed. They have claws on their toes. And this species was originally used for pregnancy tests, where you could take urine from a putatively, possibly pregnant woman and inject it in a female frog. And if they laid eggs, that would indicate that the woman was pregnant.
How did somebody find that out?
I'm not sure.
This is just amazes me. I mean, you know science, you work science, and then you come up with this concept of a pregnancy test.
Yeah, it's insane.
But it worked.
Sure. It did work. And the reason for that is that when women are pregnant, they express a hormone called human chorionic gonadotropin in their urine. And that hormone causes females to lay eggs, these frogs to lay eggs. And so obviously we have much better pregnancy assays now.
Yeah.
But that was originally why this frog was collected and actually exported out of Africa to a variety of places,
so
including
before
Europe.
So before the regular pregnancy test kits that you can now buy in Walgreens, et cetera, were there just millions of these clawed frogs all over the place waiting for injection?
There was a big industry exporting these frogs for pregnancy assays. The hypothesis goes that this frog is one of the potential vectors for the spread of the chytrid disease. Now, I should say that there's not conclusive evidence supporting that at this point.
Right.
And that's just a hypothesis that's being tested.
So when the human species, you know, gets a pandemic of some description, then, you know, all hell breaks loose in research laboratories. We try to find vaccines and medications. What's the equivalent, if there is one, for the frog business?
Yeah, that's
right?
A great
question. What are we trying to do to stop this?
Well, there are a couple efforts that are going on right now to try to help the situation. So it's too difficult at this point to get rid of the fungus from the natural environments that the frogs occur in. They have recently reported progress with treating frogs that are infected in captivity with fungicides and even antibiotics to get rid of this fungus and help them live in captivity. But we can't really treat an entire ecosystem and get rid of all the fungus, obviously, because fungus itself is a part of biodiversity, for one thing, but also it would be impossible to eradicate this chytrid fungus exclusively in the environment. So one thing that is beginning is this effort to collect and warehouse live animals in captivity that are potentially susceptible to the chytrid fungus. and potentially propagate them in captivity and release them later back into the wild. And so obviously this is a very labor-intensive and risky proposition, but for some species on the brink of extinction, it may be the only hope that they have.
Going back to antibiotics and their function, and I suppose you could argue with this fungus and the frogs, there will be, as you've just pointed out, some of the species, for whatever reasons, maybe some genetic mutation that they have, are not susceptible to this.
That's the hope.
This is a hope, or is it a statement?
There are species that it appears that individuals are not susceptible, but there are also species where the species at large appears susceptible, but it's conceivable that there would be some individuals that are rare potentially that would be impervious to the fungus and potentially be the sort of few individuals that can cause the species to persist
and grow.
And then propagate
it,
and then grow
and
again.
So, I mean,
that's right.
You could argue that this is just a totally natural process during the evolution of frogs in the first place, or species in general.
You could argue that, except for the fact that it's clear from analysis of evolutionary relationships of this pathogen from different samples in Australia and the New World and Africa and Europe and South America, that this pathogen is really dispersed quite rapidly throughout the world and was undoubtedly mediated either directly or indirectly by people.
Okay.
So as much as people are part of the natural ecology of essentially every organism on the planet now, it doesn't mean to say that we should allow human activity to cause species decline if it can be avoided.
Okay.
So I think you're right that it's a reality of the ecological landscape of these frogs now, but it still doesn't mean that we shouldn't take efforts to try to mitigate or reduce our impact.
Yeah. So then the other part of the initial thought process that I had, that there's some environmental thing. Do you think it's just loss of habitat plus this pathogen, this fungus, and there's no other message for us to take home?
Well, there's other factors that play a role in amphibian decline as well. So, for example, climate change could affect, for example, the amount of UV light that gets into the surface of the earth, and that can affect egg development in standing water that potentially are susceptible to mutation or fungal growth or other pathogen growth on the eggs.
Well,
as a result.
That's interesting because, I mean, they have this, or they had, I think they still have it, this ozone hole somewhere down over Peru and Chile. Do you have any apocryphal or more solid evidence that frog populations, for example, or any other species populations are being directly impacted by the extra ozone exposure?
The evidence is derived mostly from experiments where you take eggs into the laboratory and expose them to UV light and look at the survivability of those eggs after exposure and without exposure. And there are certain species that have more sensitivity to UV exposure than others.
And I bet the cockroach is one that has no evidence of any negative impact.
I think they generally lay eggs outside of the sunlight, so they should probably be okay. Yeah.
I know is that they resist everything except a mixture of sugar and cement. They love it. We have to take a break at that point. My name's Keith Pannell. We're here with Ben Evans from McMaster University. He's an evolutionary geneticist, and we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. We don't consider grizzlies obese, even though they can gain 21 inches of fat and eat 90 pounds of food a day.
That's because a new study reveals grizzlies evolved amazing abilities to cope with the fat they store for hibernation. For one, they safely store large amounts of fat in fat tissue, whereas that same fat in obese humans is stored in the liver and around internal organs, scarring them.
Bears have high cholesterol, but they don't develop heart disease like humans do. We also tend to get type 2 diabetes when we're overweight. That's when the body no longer responds to insulin, the hormone that directs cells to take up sugar in the blood. Over time, elevated sugar levels in the blood cause damage to organs.
In the new study on grizzlies, researchers found when they gain rapid weight in the fall, their cells continue to respond to insulin to keep their blood sugar levels stable.
What's interesting is once grizzlies hibernate, their cells do stop responding to insulin, turning them diabetic. This is so their bodies can control how much energy is being burned during hibernation.
Amazingly, even though they're diabetic during this time, their blood sugar levels remain stable. In the spring, their cells return to normal, which may be explained by a protein both grizzlies and humans share called P10.
Obese people with a mutation in their P10 face a lower risk for type 2 diabetes, which mirrors how bears behave. To test that, scientists blocked P10 in humans and saw improvement to insulin resistance in certain body tissues.
The hope is that by studying grizzlies whose bodies evolved to solve these biological challenges can one day lead to novel treatments for humans.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell here with Ben Evans, Professor of Biology from McMaster University. And we were saying all about the frogs and the demise because of habitat changes. But your other interest is a different type of species. It's a slightly more mobile, well, on a bigger scale. And that's monkeys. Tell us what you're interested in monkeys.
Okay.
Apart from the fact they're very similar to us.
Have you heard of the Rh factor in your blood?
Yes.
So that is a
rhesus something.
That's right.
Yeah, I don't know what the H is. Hot?
I think it's
hard?
Just it's an acronym for rhesus, R-H-E-S-U-S.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay.
So that's a protein that's expressed in our blood, and it was originally identified from the rhesus macaque, which is a common laboratory animal. The rhesus macaque is in the genus Macaca. It is the most widely distributed non-human primate in the world. So macaques occur from northern Africa, not in Europe, but they pick up in Pakistan and occur all the way over to Japan, and then from southern China all the way down into Indonesia, into central Indonesia. And so there are 30 species in the genus, and 7 of them occur on this tiny island in central Indonesia called Sulawesi. And Sulawesi is about 1% of the total distribution of macaque monkeys, but it contains about a third of the diversity of that group. So it's a site of a explosive speciation event in these monkeys.
And it's an isolated island.
It's an isolated island.
You can, in fact, like Darwin going to the Galapagos.
That's exactly right.
See a whole series. And so this must be highly studied little island.
Yeah, but surprisingly understudied from a molecular perspective.
All right.
So I think that's a great analogy, that just as the finches had the Galapagos for this site of incredible speciation, adaptation of beak morphology and so on, the macaque monkeys have Sulawesi, which is an explosive speciation for that group. And there's really amazing diversity in hair coloration and other morphological features that occur in different species on this tiny island.
And when you say tiny, is it bigger than Great Britain?
It's a bizarrely shaped island, so its size is deceptive because it's mostly peninsulas. It's shaped like a K.
All right.
So each of the arms of a K would correspond with a peninsula, and there would be a different species on each of the parts of the K.
Really?
Yes.
And so they don't transmigrate across or anything?
They don't.
And that's partly because the territory and the geography and the geology of those K arms is different or not?
Well, that's exactly what I'm interested in, and that's exactly what I've tried to test with molecular approaches.
All right.
So there's, just like you said, there's a bunch of explanations that could explain why there are so many species of macaques on this tiny island. And one is that they've adapted to different ecological situations on different parts of the island. And there's good reason to think that, actually. So Sulawesi was formed through the amalgamation of 4 different islands that actually collided about 5 million years ago into this single island. So this is one of the most dynamic geological regions of the entire planet. And when they collided, they brought with them different types of soil, and they're now influenced by different climatic regimes. So Sulawesi is south of the Philippines, and that affects the northern peninsula. It's east of the island of Borneo, and that affects the western part of the island. And it's east of the Moluccan Islands, which has climate that affects the southeast part of the island.
Wait a minute. You're telling me this is this tiny little island, square miles, how many?
Yeah, I mean, you can drive from one end to the other in 2 days.
Oh, so it's a big island.
Well, it's sinuous, though.
Yeah, I
think
I mean,
fly in about 45 minutes from one end to
the
other.
Okay, but I mean, that's still... So I'm just trying to think of different weather patterns on this.
I would say it's probably about the size of Rhode Island.
Okay, so it's big enough to have climactic regions.
Sure,
Right. So anyway, that's your hypothesis.
Well, that's one hypothesis. Right. Another hypothesis is that this island could have once been an archipelago in the past, which it probably was, and there's actually geological evidence to suggest that Sulawesi could have been a chain of islands in the past or an archipelago, and that the monkeys have their extraordinary diversity on this single island, which is essentially a legacy of this island being a bunch of islands in the past. Okay, so that would be an alternative to this idea that it's adaptation to different ecological zones in the island. Instead, it could have just been isolation in different parts of the island, even though it's not apparent now because it's a single island.
That's fascinating. And how long have you been sort of thinking about doing this sort of analysis? Presumably it's in the embryonic stage.
Actually, no. It's very much on its completion now.
So what's the answer?
The answer is the latter, that Sulawesi was definitely an archipelago. And I'll tell you actually how I can tell you say yes. that with confidence. It turns out that I went to frogs to try to ask this question about monkeys. So the idea is that if monkeys adapted to different ecological areas, these are semi-arboreal. They live in trees and on the ground. Sometimes they're frugivorous. They eat fruit. You would expect that they would adapt to different ecological characteristics of an environment than frogs would. Frogs are amphibians, obviously. They live in rivers. They spend part of their life as tadpoles. They would have different ecological requirements. So if that were the case, you'd expect that species distributions in frogs would have a completely different and non-related pattern to the species distributions in monkeys if the ecological adaptation hypothesis were true. As an alternative, if Sulawesi was once a chain, an archipelago, you'd expect that patterns of differentiation or population structure or species distributions in frogs and monkeys might actually correspond quite well because both of them are terrestrial and they would have limitations due to marine barriers in the same way. And so what I did was to sample monkeys and frogs throughout this island and use molecular methods to try to test whether the patterns of populations and species in each group was similar or not. And I found that they're almost identical, actually, okay. which would suggest that both groups were sort of jointly affected by the geological history of this island.
So, I mean, in a sense, what you've done here is you've outlined the issues that you're interested in. And in this particular case, unlike a lot of people who come on Science Studio, you've got an answer. You had a hypothesis and you've now got a sort of an answer to what you're comfortable with. But you keep saying that you do this by molecular methods. So
That's right.
I think the audience is now ready to sort of learn a little bit about what are the molecular methodologies. What do you mean by that?
I deploy approaches that many people with evolutionary interests do, which is to sort of have three phases in my research. The first phase is to do field work, and that means going out and collecting animals and obtaining genetic information from them or a genetic sample. And that usually involves something like blood or a tissue sample. It often involves taking a voucher specimen, which is put in a museum.
A what?
It's called a voucher specimen, and this is you kill the animal and you preserve it in formalin. And then you put that animal or the body of that animal in a museum so that it's a reference for that genetic sample and it's available for any scientist to access and do more research on morphology.
So sometimes when you go to a museum and you see these animals in formalin, formaldehyde, whatever, if I was in your game, I'd say, look, I've got an idea. I'm allowed to go in there and take a little sample of that tissue?
Absolutely.
And then, okay, so these are actually living corpses, in a sense.
I mean, very much so.
It's utilized as a facility by anybody who's interested and got the right credentials.
Very much so. And it basically empowers the future generation of scientists to understand many things about the biodiversity that we're interested in investigating. So by my going and collecting this material and then making it publicly accessible, both as a physical specimen of the body, but also as a genetic sample that other scientists can use, it essentially is a record that is publicly accessible for everybody to use, and we can learn more and more about it, especially as the technology changes in the second phase of what I do, which is DNA analysis. So currently, the DNA analysis involves sequencing the genetic code of various example genes in the genome. And at this point, we generally don't sequence the entire genome like we have for humans and many other species because it's too expensive. But in the not-too-distant future, in 5 or 10 years, we will be obtaining complete genome sequences, and we'll be able to go back to these archived genetic samples and use them and obtain complete genome sequences from those.
So these so-called voucher samples, I'm sort of intrigued by the terminology here. I mean, how many species of monkey and frog are there on this island?
Well, I should say that for primates, I never kill any primates
okay.
because obviously, they're large. It would be very heavy to carry back primates. But obviously, there's major concerns with their conservation, and we can't just go off and kill these primates. So for the primates, I was able to take hair samples from captive individuals that local people had already maintained, such as we maintain dogs, actually. They keep pet monkeys.
Yeah.
And so the hair samples have DNA in them, and I took a photo of the animal. So that was the voucher. It was a photographic record.
And I mean, it's an interesting feature that I'm not sure everybody will know. One strand of hair is enough to get the genome sequence?
I would take a clump of hair, but certainly one strand of hair has DNA in it, especially if it has the follicle in it, which has multiple cells in it.
Yes.
So, yes, you can even obtain DNA from a fingerprint because you have cells that have sloughed off your finger. So.
And enough to get the whole genome?
I don't think the whole genome, but I have a friend who does forensics, and he says he can identify individuals on the basis of a DNA fingerprint. And that would be, again, through sampling a few genes within the genome that are variable enough that you can distinguish individuals.
Okay. And now the DNA analysis, you sort of allude to the fact that it's sort of expensive, but the price is coming down and down and down.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Well, it's exciting, and yet it has a sort of a ethical responsibility that's coming with this because people – I mean, I'd love to know my genome sequence. I don't know why. And I suppose you say, well, first of all, am I going to die by the age of 50? Well, I've passed that hurdle. So, you know, now what's the next one? 70, 80, 90, right? If you know that information, you know where I'm going with this. I mean, okay, you give people the power to have information, but they don't know what they can do with that information.
Yeah, well, I think there's a little bit of a misconception in the public arena about the information content that a complete genome contains. Even if we do have everybody's complete genome, there is still a lot of information we won't know about their life. And that includes disease susceptibility, cancer risk, when they're going to die. All these things have a genetic component, but also an environmental component. Mm-hmm. We're never going to know everything about our health just with a complete genome sequence. There's a lot more to it.
I mean, we don't know very much about ourselves.
Sure, right?
I mean, you put yourself in situations and you react in a way that you wouldn't necessarily have expected and predicted you would react. So you're absolutely right. The environment, the genes, and it's a big issue.
Yep.
Okay, so frogs, monkeys, what's on the horizon since you've solved this problem of the island?
I shouldn't say it's solved. There's much more to do on that island, and there are many other groups that are working on the complexity of the situation.
How many people live there on this island?
The most densely populated island in the world is Java, which is very near Sulawesi. Mm-hmm. I think the country of Indonesia is smaller than the United States, about 230 million, and I'm just pulling this
out.
On the island, I'm going to guess, but I would say 30 million.
Oh, so, I mean, this is not some little idyllic little island.
A lot of people there.
I mean, I've had an image, right? And now it's destroyed. I mean, there's 30 million people there and 10,000 researchers like yourself running around in
Jeeps. I wouldn't say 10,000. It's more like dozens. But
okay.
And also the number 30 million is a wild guess. I'm really not sure exactly.
It's a fascinating area. And hey, good luck with it, because it's sort of one of those things that everybody gets interested in. You know, the whole business nowadays of thinking about genes. I mean, it's 1950s when Watson and Crick first sort of came up with the double helix, something like that. And now, how sophisticated we are in, you know, less than a lifetime.
Yeah, and I think it's got exciting implications. So we already mentioned health, but the work on Sulawesi also could influence conservation practices, because now we know that multiple species have this distinct population structure. We can design management strategies that target different sections of the island.
So you'll be back off to South Africa or the Serengeti Plains and, you know, pass on your information.
Let's hope so.
Hey, great. Hey, Ben Evans, McMaster University, evolutionary geneticist. Thank you for being on Science Studio.
Thank you for having me. Thanks.
And, of course, we thank Norma Martinez for putting it all together and running the interference. We'll be back next week with another Science Studio program. Bye-bye.
I'm Ace McBeth with your Synapse Flash. Congratulations to Albert J. DiRienzo, Red Sky President, for receiving the Future of Health Technology Award on May 5th. The award is given to a select breakthrough thinker whose work can help reduce suffering and extend human potential through technology. Red Sky, located in downtown El Paso, provides entrepreneurs a source for their business and scientific needs. Read more at mcasynapse.org.